tonight on Arena. Neil Martin on his love of Veal and Pipes, and Brat, Sonny and the Man with a Thousand Kids are in our TV review slot. Neil Martin, a Belfast-born composer and musician, has a career as diverse as it is distinguished, encompassing orchestral and choral compositions, television and film scores, theatre productions and groundbreaking work with traditional and contemporary music. Performance venues he has graced range from Carnegie Hall to Palazzo Vecchio. And his work with the West Ocean String Quartet has been lauded globally and beyond. Their recordings have been played aboard the International Space Station, no less. But back on Earth, Neil Martin will be part of Belfast Tradfest, which runs from July the 21st until the 28th. And Neil joins us now from our Donegal studio. Neil, it's so nice to talk to you again.
Kay, it's great to talk to you and thank you for that lovely introduction.
I know, so impressive, ooh, Neil. But I'm glad you're back down on Earth and back in Belfast. Tell us about your talk. You're going to give give a number of talks, but one is called Eel and Pipes in the Western Art Music Tradition. Mm-hmm. So when did the Eel and Pipes begin to be used outside the traditional setting?
Well, you know, in terms of orchestral stuff, as far as I'm aware, the 1979 composition of the Brendan Voyage and Sean Davy with Liam O'Flynn as the piper was the first big time that kind of pipes had been embedded within an orchestral score. They had been used in some TV film soundtracks. I can think of Kidnap by Vladimir Cosmo. I remember that sometime in the 1970s, and I knew intuitively, by the way, that it was Liam O'Flynn playing Eel and Pipes. I was fortunate enough a few years earlier, 1976 at the FLA in Buncrana, where Liam was my Eel and Pipe teacher, so I knew his sound very well. But really, I think Sean Davies' The Brenton Voyage began to break, really, that new ground.
So let's listen to, not to Sean Davy this time, but let's listen to that score from Kidnap that you're talking about. That's the theme of Kidnap, the 1978 TV series based on the book by Robert Louis Stevenson. And the Eel and Pipes there were played by Vladimir Cosmo. So, Neil, that crossover, you know, they are a temperamental instrument, aren't they?
You're telling me, Kay.
Like, would Liam have been nervous when it came to the Brendan Voyage or even Sean Davy about introducing this temperamental instrument to the orchestral?
Yeah, because there is always that element of risk. And Liam used to take great care making. He would go onto stage with the principal oboe player. Traditionally in an orchestra, the A note, the note that everybody tunes to, comes from the principal oboe player. So Liam would have spent time before the orchestra came on stage to rehearse or to perform, making sure that his A and the A of the principal oboe were the same, because that's one of the great dangers if pipes are out with an orchestra, but they're also very susceptible to climate change, to air conditioning, to, you know, if you're playing in San Diego in South California one day and you're playing in Nova Scotia the next, your pipes are going to suffer, do you know? For sure. So there always is that element of risk with it. But when the planets align, it's a very, very beautiful sound.
And is that because of the wind in it? Is that the reason that it's so temperamental?
Yeah, the reed, the principal reed in the chanter is made from traditionally made from Spanish cane. So that cane needs to be cut and needs to season for maybe a decade before it can be used. With all the right properties and the right density and so on in it. So it is a susceptible thing. And Illan pipes, they're a kind of chamber bagpipe. When they were thought about, first of all, in the late 1700s, I don't think anybody was thinking of marrying them with an orchestra. It was a kind of solo instrument, really. So its development has certainly not really changed that much from 1800 in terms of one chanter, three drones, three regulators. 99% of pipes are built like that. And they haven't really changed that much. But the development of reeds has come on a lot since. And there are some terrific reed makers about now.
Yeah, because it sounds so wonderful in the orchestral setting. There we
yes.
heard it in the Kidnap theme and, of course, in the Brendan Voyage.
Mm. Yeah, no. It sits very beautifully. It has the Illan pipes such a remarkable individual colour to them that they sit very well in that context. Strings, especially, I find hug Illan pipes in a very emotional and unique way.
Now, you, which did you learn first? Did you learn the Illan pipes or the cello? Or was it the same time?
No, well, cello first when I was about 7, and then I took up the tin whistle maybe when I was about 9 or something like that. My parents had a terrific record collection at home. Okay, we had Sean O'Rada and Seamus Ennis and Beethoven and Mozart and the Beatles and Ray Cooder and Clockwork Orange film soundtrack and Louis Armstrong. There was this great mix of music that would be played in the house. So cello first, then whistle, and then from whistle to pipes. I took up pipes when I was about 11, I think, something like that.
And were they very compartmentalised in your life, you know, in terms of where you learned them and where you practised them and even got a chance to play or perform?
Yes, at the start, because I was learning classical cello and learning traditional pipes. So they were kind of world separate, but halfway through my own teenage years, I found that their cross-fertilisation was very natural, and I began to play some airs on the traditional Irish airs and the cello. And because I could read music fluently, I started really around my university time playing Illan pipes and avant-garde 20th century compositions and so on. So I never found them separate bedfellows, to be honest. I always thought that they complemented each other in some way. I think I was very lucky to have taken up those two instruments, to tell you the truth.
And were you one of the first then to introduce the cello into traditional music?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly when I in the mid-1980s, I started playing with a band called Cran, the late Sean Corcoran and Desi Wilkinson and myself. And certainly at that stage, nobody was using a cello in a performance traditional way. Like Mihála Sulawin had used a cello, but it was in a kind of orchestral context with his own music. But in terms of inflection of Irish music, I don't think anybody was doing it before myself, and I don't mean that in a vain way. It's just how it was. And at one time, that was a very kind of frightening thought, because you had nobody to be influencing you. And at another level, it was brilliantly liberating, because who was going to say what you were doing was wrong? Do you know what I mean? You had carte blanche to go down whatever route you chose to go.
It was sometimes people would be delighted to tell you shouldn't be playing cello with traditional instruments, though.
Oh, I've heard that. I've heard that often over the years. Not so much in recent times,
no.
But certainly back in the day, I remember one very prominent musician saying there's no place for the cello in Irish music. Oh, well, there you are.
You've put him wrong.
There
so
you
we're
are.
Going to play Port Nabucchi now. Would you like to introduce that for us?
Yeah, it's a glorious air that comes from Inishvikalan in the Blasket Islands, associated with the O'Daly family, and The air has influenced many things. Seamus Heaney, the great Seamus Heaney, wrote his beautiful poem, The Given Note, having heard Sean O'Rada play this air on the piano in his house in Coolay in the late 1960s when Seamus visited him. And this recording we'll listen to now is of the West Ocean String Quartet.
There you heard Neil Martin on the cello with the West Coast String Quartet, who are your string quartet. Isn't that right, Neil?
Well, I wouldn't be that bold.
I don't mean ownership, but they're the guys you play music with.
Oh, very much. Playing in a quartet, we're celebrating 25 years together as a quartet this year. Playing in a string quartet that lasts that long is like having a quadruple marriage. Do you know what I mean? it's terrific. There's something perfect about two violins, a viola and a cello. And the space that we inhabit somewhere between the idioms of Western art music and traditional music is a very, very beguiling and happy place to be, truly.
Yes, and it must be very happy place for the audience to be because they get a bit of both, do they?
They do, and they get, a unique mix of things. We have a concert coming up next week in Letterkenny at which we will have guests in Stephen Ray, Máire Ní Gonal and Jack Warnock. So, you know, there are lots of genres and lots of ideas in the kind of mixing pot there of what we'll do.
Now, what else are you going to get up to in Belfast? You're going to collaborate with other musicians at Tradfest.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful festival. This is the sixth year of the festival and it's just going from strength to strength. And, you know, there are lectures and there are over 600 students are going to attend. They're coming from all over the place, Bermuda, Japan, Australia, Norway, France, America. It's really taken on a great energy and developing at a great pace. I have a concert on Wednesday night of that week, and that's with in the Empire Music Hall in Belfast with Donal O'Connor and Mary Dillon, two outstanding musicians. And the three of us, you know, to use that phrase again, when the planets align, Kay, there's nothing more pleasurable. And Mary and Donal and I making music is great. And then what else have I given a talk and pipes? I'm emceeing a concert in Culturland Macadam O'Fich in Belfast. And I'm doing a session on Illan pipes with two other pipers, Francie Michael Duff and...
Nicely put into my next piece of music, Sometimes, which is a piece that you composed. Tell us a little bit about that. And you're going to be on the Illan pipes. The Illan pipes don't come in for about a minute in the tune. But do you want to tell us about it, Neil?
About 20 years ago, I was signed up with a record label called Universal Records, and they wanted me to make an album, an Illan pipe-based album. And there's an orchestra on this album as well. And I wrote a fair bit of the music, some on the traditional tracks that I arranged and so on, but I wrote a fair bit of the music. And this is a track that I wrote. It's kind of a simple thing, but I enjoy listening to it whenever I hear it now and again. It's simple, but it kind of has its own filmic, emotional quality to it, I think.
Well, now let's listen to Sometimes.
Thank you.
There's Neil Martin coming in on the Uilleann Pipes there in his own composition Sometimes. My thanks to Neil Martin. You can catch Neil at various performances, talks and masterclass at Belfast Tradfest. Full details on Belfast Traditional Music, belfasttraditionalmusic.com. Now it's time for TV reviews. Sorry, I was just talking to Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon about all the shows we've seen. First up is Sunny, based on the novel The Dark Manual by Killarney author Colin O'Sullivan. It's set in a semi-futuristic Japan and follows Susie Sakamoto, whose life is upended when her husband Masa and son seemingly perish in a mysterious plane crash. When a colleague of Masa's shows up at Susie's door with a domestic robot named Sunny as a consolation gift to help her with her grief, things start to take a strange turn. Now, former Brad Pack member and director Andrew McCarthy has revisited the origins of the famous 80s group of young actors to make a feature documentary called Bratz that looks at the Brad Pack's cultural impact 30 years on. And finally, The Man with a Thousand Kids is a new three-part Netflix documentary series that pieces together the havoc created by a Dutch sperm donor, Jonathan Meyer, after an anonymous email to a fertility clinic sparked an investigation. As I said, I'm joined by Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon, who are here to review all these series. So, Jen, Sunny. It's written by a Kerry man, Colin O'Sullivan. The name of the book he wrote was The Dark Manual, but this is now called Sunny. So it's set in Kyoto, Japan, where I think Colin is now based in Japan. So what's the premise for the series?
So you're saying there, like, I mean, with Apple, we know that they are the prestige streamer that are so well known now for their sci-fi, their dark futurism. So this
Silo,
is,
for example.
Exactly. So this is another kind of level of that. But I mean, what is interesting and different about Sunny is it may be based on, you know, this novel, The Dark Manual, as I said, but it's been brought to the screen by, I don't know if you remember the show The Affair, and that screenwriter, Katie Robbins. And it comes from, because of that, it comes from a much more human and relatable place, because there is shades of, like, the nucleus, like, of The Affair within it, because it gives us
this
that...
This is the Dominic West to Ruth Wilson
it
show.
It gives you that marital conundrum of, can you ever truly know a person? Because you're saying there, we have Rashida Jones. She's no stranger to Apple Sci-Fi. She was in Silo herself. And she plays this grieving wife and mother who her, you know, husband Masa and her son Zen, they were on this doomed flight, and it is, there are no apparent survivors. So then a mysterious stranger arrives at her door with this robot that said it was this homebot that's been programmed by her husband. And given that she always thought he worked in refrigeration and worked with fridges, she is kind of surprised by this, and she's surprised by this as well because she hates robots.
Okay, well, so we have the clip where that very man turns up at her door. So Susie, played by Rashida Jones, is visited by her husband's colleague Yuki Tanaka, and he's played by John Kunimura, and he's brought a robot with him.
I don't want a pet. I don't want a robot. I hate robots.
May I ask why?
Because they're creepy.
Oh.
But robots are expressions of their creators. Sunny was created by your husband. You do not find Masa creepy.
Not till now.
I hope that is not true, Susie-san. The Masa I know is a good man. And I believe he would take comfort in knowing you have Sunny. Please. Masa would take great comfort.
Okay, fine. I'll keep it. Just tell me how to turn it off.
I'm Sunny. I'm so happy to finally meet you. Bring it in.
Okay.
I'm a hugger, but we'll get there.
Don't hold your breath.
I can't. I don't breathe.
Classic Masa-san, no?
Wait, what's classic Masa?
That sense of humor. He worked so hard to make this new model jovial.
Sorry, I'm confused. Masa works in refrigerators.
I get it. You are also Laugh Riot.
It's a great clip. So he doesn't work. He didn't work in refrigerators.
Yeah, and that makes her suspicious, obviously, because if her husband had lied to her about his work for over 10 years, what else was he lying about, basically? So she begins to pull at this thread and tries to understand where this robot has come from. What is the company that he worked for? What are their, you know, true ambitions? And she has to contend with that. And then also her shifty mother-in-law, Noriko, she seems to know a lot more about her son hidden life that she was ever letting on to Susie. And Susie has been this outsider for her whole, you know, time in Japan.
Because she's a foreigner.
And she had never learned the language, and she said that's because of her dyslexia. But the thing is, when you go back into her and Masa, the beginnings of their relationship, she said she was running away from the US because she wanted to be alone. And then he opened her out. Love came into her life. He said, you know, take a chance on us as two people together in a relationship, but then now she's left completely isolated. And that's really what the series is about. It is a mystery story per se. Yes, it is on the surface, but beneath it, it really is a meditation on grief and the loneliness and how you reconnect with people, and be that through, you know, technology, or be that through that nothing can actually replace human connection.
So Chris, Susie is now left with Sonny.
Sonny.
So how do they get on?
At first, they clash. Straight after that clip, the mystery man tells Susie that, you know, if you want to shut Sonny up, you just say sleep. But only she can say sleep to her. But for some reason, despite the fact that, you know, Susie is literally putting Sonny into a closet, she finds her way out because she just wants to help. I think she knows that she's there to kind of pick up the pieces. She's there to, you know, replace Masa, and she either wants to clean around the house or just talk and get to know Susie, because it's almost as if she knows her. And I think one of the greatest tricks that this show pulls is doing something like an awful lot of, you know, TV shows and films and cartoons have had, you know, domestic robots and robot pals, and it's nothing new. But this is the first time where after about an hour or two, you stop seeing Sonny as a robot, and you just start seeing her as this supporting character, and almost this, you know, it is a mystery, it is a thriller, it is a bit of a sci-fi, but sometimes it feels like a detective series where the two of them are going around Kyoto trying to figure out what was Masa at. Are there killer robots on the loose? We should say as well, the opening scene of a show called Sonny involves a slaughter where robots are involved. And that to me is brilliant, because I was wondering why have they called it.
And can you tell us who's slaughtering who?
We don't. We know that it's taking place in a secret division of the company where Masa works, where he said he was building refrigerators, but clearly he wasn't, and clearly something has gone wrong with the robot. So that creates a bit of tension in the relationship between Susie and Sonny, because we know that despite the fact that Sonny wants to be friends, she probably shouldn't trust her with her life.
Oh, right. And is it always Sonny pushing towards Susie and Susie pushing her away? Is she a she? She is a she,
yeah. And I have to say, like, they've dispensed with CGI for Sonny, and yes, I think that's amazing. They actually got a robot like built in New Zealand for the show itself, and I think, you know, I admire that, because it gives this kind of warmth to it, and she feels tangible. Like, she is this cutesy animatronic robot that kind of reminded me of like Johnny Five from Short Circuit, but now,
exactly, yeah,
for now. And like, that makes her very adorable, and you want to see their characters develop together. And it is kind of like this double act where, you know, they're enemies to friends. You think that's going to develop over the next while, but as Chris said, can Susie really trust her? We don't know, and we'll have to see. And that's where the show kind of tension comes as well into the show.
And is it a thriller? Is it a comedy? What is it?
It's a mixture of both. It's like there's dark comedy there. It's a bit of a sci-fi. It's obviously a mystery. Sometimes it feels a bit like a whodunit. I think all of these elements work very well together. And we mentioned Apple's kind of run of sci-fi shows, Silo, Severance. This should kind of fill the Severance hole, because it reminded me an awful lot of that series. You know, about a guy who works at a company, he doesn't know when he goes home what the company does. We have that kind of here with Rashida Jones, who is very good at comedy work. She is in this very serious situation where she's grieving the loss of a loved one. She doesn't really know exactly what happened to them. She doesn't know what sort of trouble she's getting into. The more she investigates it, it reminded me an awful lot of Severance. So that's a very, very good start.
It's very Black Mirror as well.
Yeah,
I think
very Black Mirror.
It is like an elongated Black Mirror. And also, what's really enjoyable about it, it's 35 minutes per episode. You know, they pack a lot into those 35 minutes, though. And we both said it looks stunning.
The production
design is absolutely beautiful.
Stars at 5 from you, Jen, for Sonny.
I think it has, you know, it's an engaging sci-fi drama that actually has a beating heart. And I think that's something that it should be, you know, rewarded for in that way. And I would give it 3.5.
3.5. And from you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm going to go the same myself. Yeah, it does have a novelistic kind of tone. It is a bit of a slow burner, but stick with it. I think Rashida Jones is a wonderful lead here. So 3.5 out of 5.
3.5 out of 5 for both of you for Sonny. So the term Brat Pack was coined by the writer David Bloom in a 1985 New York Magazine article branding a group of young actors who rose to stardom in the 1980s, among them Rob Lowe, Demi Moore, Emilio Estevez, director Andrew McCarthy, himself a former Brat Pack member, has made a feature documentary called Brats that revisits the origins of the group and their cultural impact 30 years on. So recall some of the Brat Pack movies for us, Chris, and tell us who is Andrew McCarthy. Would we remember him from?
We absolutely would. Yeah, we remember him from Pretty in Pink. We remember him from the St. Elmo's Fire ensemble. And alongside, you know, there was Emilio Estevez, there was Ali Sheedy, there was Anthony Michael Hall, Judd Nelson, Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald. The list goes on. But those kind of names that I mentioned, they were, you know, official quote unquote members of the Brat Pack, because David Blum in 1985, he went out to interview Emilio Estevez. He did this profile on himself and the actors that were coming up around him. This idea that all of these hot young actors in America, they were all, you know, friends, and they were all kind of changing Hollywood. They were changing the face of American cinema, but they weren't actually pals. But anyway, this journalist, David Blum, he interviewed Emilio. He went to back to New Yorker. He writes up this piece and he comes up with the term Brat Pack, just as an amusing moniker, just as a sort of, you know, he wanted some sort of term, a catch-all term to describe these actors. It was a little bit mean-spirited. He kind of suggested in the piece that, you know, these were actors that didn't really take themselves seriously or the craft seriously. And it annoyed the heck out of Andrew McCarthy, so much so that it annoyed Emilio Estevez something awful too, but he did let it go in the end. But Andrew McCarthy basically spent the 4 years thinking about this term and wondering, though, despite the fact that he stayed busy, that he was a director, you know, that he was quite prolific, you know, he's never been out of work, he always, I think, wondered, if I wasn't part of that Brat Pack of actors, would I have got the chance to work with Scorsese or Spielberg? Would I have been a serious actor? So he takes this kind of, you know, grievance that he's had for 40 years, as I say, and he calls up all the other Brat Pack members and he interviews them and says, did this annoy you as much as it annoyed
and
me?
And did it?
Oh my God, Jen? What is wrong with this man? Sometimes I had to say. Like, we have been re-examining our past through pop culture for the longest while, where you have something like, say, Brooke Shields' fantastic but really harrowing documentary Pretty Baby, and that was examining what it was like to be in that burning spotlight at such a tender age and how it made her feel about her body being scrutinised and to be sexualised in the media and in such a blatant, very unapologetic way, and what that does to your mental state or how it affects your worldview. This is not that. No. This is a man who seems to have this chip on his shoulder about something that a moniker, just a very neat catch-all term, as you said, that happened over 40 years ago. And you're like, why is this still, you know, within his soul, like burning on fire in his soul, when he's interviewing someone like Demi Moore, who managed, you know, to get away from that idea of the Brat Pack and become one of Hollywood's biggest earners. But, you know, at a cost. We had so many stories about Demi Moore, as you know, more famous as she got more famous, as she was being a diva, she was demanding too much money. He never goes into that or explores how she moved away from that moniker, but she, you know, also took a lot of heat. He never talks about something like, he doesn't know what it's like to be at the bottom of the rung, like say somebody like Drew Barrymore, who was kicked out of Hollywood, and after, you know, she went through rehab, nobody wanted to hire her. She was blackballed completely. She ended up cleaning, you know, in a fast food restaurant, and that's rock bottom. And then she worked her way back to the top. And that was because she was under this tag as a wild child in the press and nobody wanted to go near her. These are the severe cases of what happens when you are, you know, given a title. And he doesn't seem to understand that that's severe and that was happening in Hollywood, that the Brat Pack is just something that was silly and frivolous and fun, just a silly title that someone like, it's until he interviews, you know, a fellow member like Rob Lowe, and Rob Lowe, who has been through serious scandal in Hollywood, as we all remember, he puts a totally different spin on it. And he's just like, it was a blast. What's wrong
Get
with you?
Yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also, you know, we changed the trajectory of culture in Hollywood, because without the Brat Pack, there wouldn't have been this concentration on hot young things in Hollywood. You never have a show like Friends, which is, you know, concentrated on this young, telegenic group of friends. Like, they would never have that without the Brat Pack. So he's kind of trying to help them out.
This is not what Bratz is about.
No, it's like a weird therapy session for Andrew McCarthy.
Oh,
sad.
Yeah. Okay. One I don't think I'll join. Chris, stars from you.
I was so disappointed in him. I kind of felt sorry for him. But I do think Rob Lowe is a hoot here. I mean, he just, Andrew McCarthy has created that narrative that we're talking about, that the Brat Pack was almost his curse. Rob Lowe just throws a grenade in that and says, we were a part of Hollywood history. Enjoy it. So it's going to get 3 stars because any film that features scenes from those films and that brings those actors together deserves at least 3.
From you, Jen?
Well, if you have someone like Bret Easton Ellis, you know, in this film that he doesn't even get to talk about less than zero, you're like, what's the point of this? And I felt there were so many missed opportunities that I could only give it 2, unfortunately.
Okay, 2 and 3 out of 5. We have to move on because we've 1,000 kids to look out for. So, the man who had 1,000 kids, Jen,
yes.
Who was he?
He was this Viking-like Dutchman called John Jacob Major, who has this mane of hair that seemed to be a selling point for a lot of these prospective parents who are unable to have kids of their own. Now, this might sound like one of those OTT kind of documentaries you'd see on Channel 4, like late at night, that was a bit Euro trash, but there is something a lot more serious and disturbing in it. It follows the lives of several different couples from the Netherlands and later in Australia who've decided to use a sperm donor to get pregnant. And they found this man who was, you know, willing. It very much concentrates at the beginning of, you know, you're going through these files of men and really concentrating on what is it you want from a prospective donor. They want lovely tumbling locks. They want blue eyes. They want him to be white. And that kind of pinpoints these issues around what we're looking at here. It is like on the other side of things from his point of view as the sperm donor. Almost like eugenics.
Yes. And this guy is very generous with his sperm. He gives it not only to clinics, but he makes house calls.
Yeah, what a
sentence. It is creepy. I mean, I love the people who are, you know, trying to get pregnant, but he is just quite creepy.
He really is, which kind of makes it difficult. I mean, even at the beginning when, you know, they find these guys, we're talking about there's a lesbian couple, there is a married couple where the guy was previously married and had a vasectomy, but he wanted a child with this wife. There was a person on her own who didn't want to wait around for anyone. She wanted to do this by herself, but they were all looking up sperm donors online. They all landed on this guy, and depending where they were, at first in the Netherlands, because we meet people on the other side of the world then, depending on where they were, they had a different name for this guy. So some knew him as Jonathan or some people knew him as Martin. And they told him, and he was telling them all the same story, that I am here to help out families who can't have a baby themselves, and I've decided that I'm going to help out 5 families and you're the 3rd family. He was spinning this line, and really they might have been the 80th, the 100th family, whatever.
So he's populating and populating, and this could be very dangerous because people could meet a sibling that they wouldn't know.
That's it, yeah. So we eventually get the doctor's perspective in a clinic where he says that it is the Luke and Leia syndrome, referring, of course, to, you know, Luke and Leia from Star Wars, not knowing that they were siblings. This is a very serious problem where when these kids grow up, they might meet one another and feel that there's a connection. They might be attracted to each other, and then you run the risk of an incestuous relationship. So this is a very serious thing. So the courts actually did, you know, we do eventually reach a point in the documentary where we learned that, you know, the courts got involved and there were lawsuits and that there was a ban, but that didn't stop him. He just moved on to a different clinic. And I was going to say about Jonathan as well, there's this idea that he's very charming and that he's attractive. And yeah, on the surface, it's like, okay, it's his blonde curls that attracted him. It's his bright blue eyes. But he never hid the fact that he was an absolute weirdo. You only have to look at his videos to know that this guy is a complete oddball. But unfortunately, they were all, spellbound by his looks.
Okay, so should we watch it? Stars out of 4. Out of 5, even.
Stars out of 1,000.
It's a very important story. I do feel for the victims. They are quite brave in coming forward with their story. Unfortunately, the way the documentary around it is a little bit trashy at times, a little bit overbearing, very repetitive, and it has this comedic edge that didn't really sit right with me. So 2.5 out of 5.
And 2.5. And for you, Jen?
Yeah, it would be a great long read, you know, from The Guardian or The Cut, but Netflix has this habit of turning them into these identical documentaries that you've seen the likes of before, like The Tinder Swindler. So it felt a bit like AI had generated it, which is sad because it's an important, serious story. And they didn't treat it with a lot of, you know, severity sometimes. And so I think I'd only have to give it 2.5.
2.5. 2.5 from both of you. And that's from The Man with 1,000 Kids, Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser. Thank you very much. 2024, it marks 40 years since Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds released their debut album, From Her to Eternity. The Bad Seeds were formed by Australian singer Nick Cave after the dissolution of his first band, the feral party-loving Birthday Party. The bulk of From Her to Eternity was recorded in Trident Studios in London and released by Mute Records in 1984. In this album, we see Cave's lyricism develop, creating unforgettable characters and narratives in some of the songs. Peter Murphy joins me now to discuss the inception of the album and its resonance for audiences today. So, Peter, your first introduction to Cave came through an earlier project of his called The Birthday Party.
Yes, I was lying awake at night at the tender age of 12 or so with the dented transistor under the sheets, trying to discern through the hail of static the John Peel show, when I heard some sort of, I can only describe it as a sort of sonic abomination called Release the Bats, which was kind of a breakthrough single for The Birthday Party. 1981, I think, if you could call it a single, even.
And was it the cacophony and the music, or was it Cave himself?
It was the insanity of somebody ranting sex vampire bite over what sounded like some crude parody of post-punk rock music. But they were a great band, The Birthday Party, and everything that happened subsequently with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds on this record was in some way an extension of and a reaction to it. But they were...
And were they feral, as I say, the band itself? Were they living life? They were in London then.
They both sounded and lived feral. They sounded a bit like a mashup of Captain Beefheart and Pere Ubu and the pop group. Kind of tribal rhythms, really angular, skewed, noisy guitar from Roland S. Howard. And they were huge in Melbourne. They decided to move to London because they were under the illusion that London was where everything was happening. They met Bon Scott from AC/DC's Coffin arriving in Melbourne as they were leaving, which was some sort of bad omen, I think, for them and for everyone else. Arrived in London, realised that it wasn't all that it was knocked up to be. Were living in extreme poverty and squalor. Ingesting, they had a particularly, what people at the time said, an Australian attitude to drugs, which is they'd swallow everything that was given to them. A lot of amphetamines, a lot of heroin, and a lot of booze. But they were an incredibly innovative, cutting edge.
And how long did they last before they imploded and the Bad Seeds were formed?
Maybe about 4 years, with a succession of brilliant albums like Junkyard and EPs like Mutiny, which you can very much hear the no pun intended, the seed of everything that Nick Cave was going to become.
Okay, and was it Cave then thought, lads, I have to get out of this and do something else?
It kind of just ran out of oxygen and blood and the wherewithal to stand up anymore.
So how many of them came and became the Bad Seeds?
So Mick Harvey was the backbone always of the Birthday Party, and he had the thankless task of being sort of like the circus overseer, the one who would book the tours and find the passports. Nick Cave incidentally lost his passport so many times during this period that they give him an outsized passport for people with special needs.
So what was Cave looking to do here, From Her to Eternity?
When the Birthday Party imploded...
Am I right saying it's just Cave or it's the group?
Well, he did a series of some solo things, and he collaborated. There was a project called The Immaculate Consumptive, which he embarked upon with Lydia Lunch, the New York no-wave multi-hyphenate whirlwind of a woman, and they wrote 51 act plays together. Mark Almond was in on it as well, ex Soft Cell. This was just sort of like an obscene, blasphemous cabaret that toured, but it did get him interested in literature, and at that time he began exploring language a lot more. His father was a very accomplished academic who once wrote a study on Ned Kelly, and read to the young Nick Cave passages from Lolita and Crime and Punishment. Crime and Punishment has a huge influence on the title track of the first album, From Her to Eternity. It's almost like a punk rock Raskolnikov pacing his garret, listening to the footsteps of a girl upstairs.
Oh, what a wonderful cue to the track. amazing, isn't it? It's fantastic stuff seeping through the floor. Oh,
I
my
can't
God.
Tell you what it does to my heart to hear that on RT Radio 1 in the evening.
Why did we get the whip out in the well of misery? But that is fantastic. So he's talking, he's creating narratives and creating character.
He began to write in character on this record. I mean, he'd done it to some extent with The Birthday Party. There's a crossover here with his what eventually became his first novel, And the Ass Saw the Angel, which began as a screenplay called Swampland, that he was writing for an Australian producer called Evan English, who was working with John Hillcoat. John Hillcoat eventually went on to make The Proposition, which Nick Cave wrote with him, and The Road and The Ghosts of the Civil Dead, an unbelievable Australian movie. So Swampland was an unfilmable, overwritten, rambling, insane and quite brilliant screenplay that eventually became a novel, but you can hear the voice of the mute Euchred Ucro, who's the main protagonist. You can hear him all throughout this record. It's a sort of Southern Gothic Faulkner meets Herman Melville meets Flannery O'Connor, but filtered through a deranged comic book sensibility.
Yeah, no, The Well of Misery that we're going to play now, that there isn't much comic book in this. I mean, there's a lashing of whips and there's, you know, people are having a hard time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, what's mad about From Her to Eternity is it's halfway between almost like a twisted bad dream of what blues music is or what gospel is, and also the European avant-garde, which came from Blixa Bargeld, who's crucial to this record. Blixa was the leader.
Oh, yes, but he's the German.
German, Einsturzende Neubauten leader, industrial, experimental, incredibly confrontational. He looked like a sort of praying mantis. He had cheekbones that...
I was just going to say, I didn't want to be superficial, but I was dying to know what they all looked like.
Yeah, yeah. Backcombed hair, skeletal cheekbones. You could cut slice Brennan's bread with, et cetera, et cetera. But he hated the guitar and he hated guitar players. So his approach to guitar playing is basically atonal and abusive. He was locked in an abusive relationship with the guitar. Didn't use any effects pedals. Used a metal slide. And there's great stories of him going on tour and, you know, not even having his own guitar and asking for the lend of a guitar from the support bands. He was very taken with Sonic Youth when he toured with them, because Sonic Youth used to keep all their cheap Japanese copy guitars in a giant bin.
We're dying to play The Well of Misery. Is there anything you want to tell us before we play it?
Just listen to the words. They teeter uncertainly between comedy and horror.
If you can hear it over the flip flash. Yeah. There we go. The same God that abandoned her has turned, abandoned me. Deep in the desert of despair, I wait at the well of misery. I mean, they're in a chain gang or something. There's something terrible going on there.
Like a lot of these songs from this year, 1984, take place in a sort of Southern Gothic hellscape of the mind, except transferred to the outback. There are riffs all over the record. You know, Saint Hook is basically Huckleberry Finn on crack, moved to the city, runs into Elvis. It gets very hairy indeed. Cabin Fever is sort of like if Moby Dick had turned into Pirates of the Caribbean on mushrooms. But what's amazing is the lyrics read really well, which you can't say of a lot of... I mean, Funhouse by the Stooges is one of my favourite records of all time, but you wouldn't spend a long time reading it. If you read the lyrics from this period in the collected lyric books, they actually really work in a sort of bizarre Rimbaudian hallucinatory poetry fashion.
So then in the mix of these very unique and inventive songs that he creates himself, we have some covers.
Yeah.
So will we talk about Avalanche? That's Leonard Cohen's.
Yeah, there's like the mad thing from this period is when everybody was talking about William Burroughs and heroin and goth and blah, blah, blah. Nick Cave always clung steadfastly to a sort of traditionalism. So I think he heard songs from a room when he was 12 or 13 from a friend's older sister and thus began a lifelong love affair with Leonard Cohen stuff. So Avalanche, bizarrely, kicks off the first Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds record, Leonard Cohen cover, and the previous year he'd covered In the Ghetto by Elvis Presley because he sort of saw Elvis as a Christ-like passion figure in his tragedy and fall.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit of Avalanche before we have to say goodbye.
I stepped in to an avalanche. It covered up my soul. When I am not this hunchback that you see, I sleep beneath the golden hill. You wish to conquer pain, you must learn. Learn to serve me well. You strike my side by accident as you go down for your gold.
That's Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds version of Leonard Cohen's Avalanche from Her to Eternity. 40 years since it was debuted, and Peter Murphy has been looking back on it. So you definitely, I think you have sold it to us all, Peter.
Well, that's a much more recent version of Avalanche, but it's kind of beautiful to hear how far he came. He's kind of turned into Leonard Cohen in a way, the original Avalanche.
Beautiful voice.
It's pretty raw, but when I was listening to the album today, my concluding thought was to pine for a time when music this uncompromising and unconventional was actually at the center of the culture.
Well, that sounds a great way to finish that. Peter Murphy, thank you so much. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Sanwu and Liam Murphy. Niall McMonagle is on sound. Ali Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Pauline McNamara. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.